Hi, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us for Midday. When he ran for governor, Republican Larry Hogan got 22% of the vote in Baltimore City, but he won 53% of the vote in the 1st District, which includes Harbor East, Little Italy, Canton, Fells Point, Greektown, Bayview, and other historic southeast Baltimore neighborhoods. Today, a look at the race for the Baltimore City Council in the 1st District. My guests are two young, dynamic candidates who are new to politics and who prevailed in crowded primaries last spring. Democrat Zeke Cohen and Republican Matt McDaniel join me in Studio A. If McDaniel does what Hogan did and wins the district, he would become the first Republican to hold a seat on the city council since 1942 and the first Republican to hold any elective office in Baltimore in more than 50 years. Zeke Cohen and Matt McDaniel on the future of the first, today on Midday, right after the news. And welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us on this autumnal spring day. It's like 80 degrees here, at least at the international headquarters of WIPR Industries, and I hope it's as pretty where you are as it is where we are. Today, we're going to have a conversation about one of the many races for the Baltimore City Council that will result in a brand new member of the council. With retirements and some incumbent losses and a couple of members running for mayor instead of their council seat, 8 of 14 seats on the council will be occupied by people who are new to the job. Luke Broadwater from the Baltimore Sun dug through the archives to find out that the last Republican to hold a seat on the city council was elected in 1923. David Ellison served until 1942, and there hasn't been a Republican council member since. So in fact, as far as we can tell, no Republican has won an election in Baltimore since 1963, when Theodore McKeldin was elected mayor. But observers of the election this time around, in an election cycle that has proven to be as unpredictable as any in recent history, say that there's a decent chance that the Republican drought may come to an end. They point to the 1st District in southeast Baltimore, and the reason? Larry Hogan. The popular Republican governor carried that district when he ran against Anthony Brown in 2014. Republican Matt McDaniel is mounting a serious campaign in the 1st District against his Democratic challenger Zeke Cohen. Both candidates are young, charismatic, and personable. Matt McDaniel is a 28-year-old lawyer. He's a native of Frederick County. He attended Catonsville High School, Loyola University, Maryland, and the University of Baltimore Law School. He's never held public office. Zeke Cohen is also new to politics. He's 31, a Massachusetts native who came to the area in 2004 to attend Goucher College. He holds a master's degree in public policy from Johns Hopkins University, and in 2011, he co-founded The Intersection, an educational nonprofit that works to improve outcomes for students in city schools. Matt McDaniel and Zeke Cohen join me here in Studio A. It's good to see you guys. Thanks for coming in.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Thanks a lot.
So, Matt, let's start with you. What do you specifically bring to the Baltimore City Council?
Sure. It's when you put the history in context, that is quite a while. But look, we started out this
quite a while since a Republican served.
Well, that's right.
Right.
Actually, anyone who's not a Democrat has served. Look, we started out this campaign probably a year and a half ago with 9 very qualified people running for office, and 3 Republicans and 6 Democrats. People are very interested in the race, very interested in the community, and today it's down to 2. And I still hold that both people running for the office really do care and are really looking to make the 1st District a better place. When talking with people, door knocking, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, you get this feeling that people don't feel like they're being heard, that they're not being listened to, and that's not necessarily a city problem, it's a state problem, it's a federal problem. But giving people an option in November is not a bad thing. Giving people a choice, a different direction, it's something that the governor has been trying to do, and he's done things that are popular and has done things that are not as popular, but really trying to work across boundaries, build bridges, and continue a dialogue. And I think that's something that we're trying to do in our race, is to kind of open up those avenues of communication that have been shut down for so long. And I think we've been really doing it. And that's something that we can bring to the council, is opening up lines of communication and dialogue that I don't think have either existed for a very long time, or to bring a changes in accountability that people have been asking for.
And see, Cohen, there will be a very large freshman class, regardless of who wins on November 8th in all of the races throughout the city. More than half, 8 of the 14 city council members will be brand new. There are some folks who worry about that. They say, you know, these are folks who don't know the legislative process. They don't know how things work, the mechanisms of government. Do you have any concerns about that for yourself? And what kind of stuff are you going to be able to bring to the table in the first district?
Yeah, so I'm actually incredibly excited about this new freshman class coming in. And I've spent a lot of time talking to my colleagues, hopefully future colleagues, Shannon Sneed and Chris Burnett and John Bullock and Ryan Dorsey and the whole class, just amazing people. And I think what this new council recognizes is that it's not about us as individuals, but it's about how do we work together to make our whole city better. Because I think one of the challenges we have in Baltimore is that too often we fall into silos, and it's part of why our city remains so segregated. But I think what you're going to see with this new class coming in and with the folks that are already in the council and the new mayor is that there's going to be a lot of cross-district collaboration, that we're going to be really reaching out across the lines of difference to figure out what are the citywide problems and how can we all have impact. Because at the end of the day, something we said in my campaign is we can't just care about people south of Fayette Street. We need to care about those north of Fayette Street as well. Even though that's the 13th district, that's outside the first, we know that if we continue to have concentrated poverty anywhere in our city, it will bleed out. And so we need to be focused on caring about each other and caring about all of our citizens. To your question about what I would bring, Tom, as an educator, as someone who's thought a lot about young people in this city, I bring a particular passion and also a spirit of entrepreneurialism. You know, when I taught in West Baltimore and then in South Baltimore, one of my concerns was that I felt like young people didn't have enough access to their democracy. And by that, I mean there weren't enough avenues for them to participate. And in our schools, we're not doing a good enough job of teaching civic engagement. And so about 5.5 years ago, with a couple other teachers, I started a nonprofit where we've been teaching young people to be directly engaged in the democratic process. And we've seen young people, you've had them on this show, speak out on issues like gun violence and immigration. We've seen them go off to college. We've seen them help pass 2 laws, the DREAM Act and the Firearm Safety Act at the state level. And that's the kind of entrepreneurial spirit I want to bring to the city council. I want to think about how we can create a new generation of citizenship so that our democracy here in Baltimore is much more robust.
And Matt McDaniel, the way the city charter is set up, the mayor in this town has a lot of power. Council President Jack Young introduced a bill last spring to attenuate some of that power. That bill passed, and then it was vetoed by the mayor, and the override and the veto did not pass. So right now, as things stay as, you know, status pro ante, the way they have been before, what do you think the capacity of the council as a whole is to move the needle in the city of Baltimore? What can a city council member and the council as a whole do in a real and practical way?
Well, I think first off, you know, we're going to have a new mayor. And whoever that person is, very interesting politics going on there right now, but whoever that person is will come in with a good deal of political capital. And we need to be able to work together in order to help spend that political capital. And most people are running on change. Most people are running on, you know, what drives people to run for public office is they've seen an issue and they're attempting to correct it. I think as the council, we do have and debatably don't use the oversight function of the council effectively. I mean, when we're looking at budgets, when we're looking at especially the DPW budget, which we don't exactly have control over, but we do have subpoena power, there are a lot of questions that people are asking, whether it's water bills or property taxes or how money's being spent. I mean, there's a ballot issue about the children and youth investment. It's a great idea, but are we sure that that money is going to get to where it needs to go? I mean, it's the 21st century. I mean, I can find out my water bill online, but I can check my bank account statement online. as a city, we need to be able to see where our money is being spent.
So you're concerned about the implementation of it? You're concerned that the money simply will be collected but won't be allocated in the right place? Or are you concerned about the source itself of the funding, for example, the youth initiative you just mentioned?
Well, in the youth initiative, I'm concerned about how it will be spent. That was one of my principal concerns. It's a good idea. I'd rather it be spent on kids than on other things. But when we've seen, and former federal prosecutors have looked into it, when we've seen how money from the city goes to an LLC that goes to another LLC that winds up in Chicago, I mean, tracking that money is something that's so important, especially when we're talking about youth centers and getting money into the city where it needs to go. But more importantly, I guess more broadly, the city council does have a financial oversight responsibility. And when you look at the city's budget, especially 10, 15, 20 years out, making these projections, at the current growth rate of basically 0% growth, you're going to run into building and mounting deficits and debt that the city won't be able to afford, you know, 15 or 20 years from now. So I think we need to be proactive, prospective, and get our financial house in order. It might not be the things you put up in lights on a campaign, but I think those are the most important things to focus on going forward.
And just quickly, I assume you support a reduction in the property tax.
I do.
Right. And Zeke Cohen, everybody running for mayor and everybody, a lot of people running for the city council also say they support a reduction in the property tax. When it comes to financing some of the great programs that, you know, are being proposed by some of your, you know, this potential freshman class and by people running for citywide office, how do we pay for them? What do you think the future of the fiscal, is our fiscal house going to be in order 5 years, 10 years from now, or even next fiscal year?
Yeah, so, you know, to answer that, Tom, I think it's really important that we have some historical context. And, you know, we're in a city where we've seen a real disinvestment from young people. Part of what motivated me to run for office was teaching in a school that lacked heat, air conditioning, and drinkable water for the kids because of lead in our pipes. Seeing successive years of rec centers get cut. Seeing young people who don't see a future in Baltimore City, who see this city as having abandoned and turned its back on them, and hearing those stories, and also seeing the potential in our youth. You know, from my days as a teacher and now working with young people, growing up in abject poverty, but still managing to make it and to contribute and to go off to college, to the question of how to pay for it, I think we need to be much smarter with our money. I do think this city needs to get its fiscal house in order. Every agency should be audited. North Ave should be audited consistently. I also think there's some work to be done, and I was talking to a group last night on going after slum landlords, targeting nuisance and vacant properties. There's some folks in my district, Chrissy Anderson and Matt Gonter and some others that come to mind immediately, that have been working really hard on the vacancy issue. And we know that we have a number of slum landlords that often don't live in our city, but take advantage, have houses that are uninhabitable. They become drug houses. In the eastern part of my district, they're oversaturated with mostly immigrant families, people being taken advantage of. We should strategically target slum and vacant landlords.
And that's going to help us reduce spending and increase revenue? How does that impact the revenue side?
I would dramatically increase the tax on slum and vacant landlord properties. I think there is money to be recouped. And when I walk around in some of our neighborhoods, the communities of Bayview, of Eastwood, of Graceland Park, of Dundalk, of Browning Highway, even Patterson Park and Highland Town, these communities are being taken advantage of by people who are profiting off of the misery of our city. And frankly, I'd like to see some of that tax revenue be taken back.
Zeke Cohen's the director and co-founder of The Intersection, a nonprofit that works with Baltimore City youth. He's a Democrat running for the Baltimore City Council in the 1st District. Matt McDaniel is a lawyer in private practice who is the Republican candidate for that council seat. We'll have more on the 1st District council race when we come back from a quick break. We'd like to involve you in our conversation with Matt McDaniel and Zeke Cohen. You can give us a buzz, 410-662-8780. You can drop us an email midday at WIPR.org or send us a tweet at Midday Tom Hall. Lots more on the first district council race in the city of Baltimore when we come back. Stick around.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us today for Midday. By the way, coming up tomorrow, another edition of Smart Nutrition with our nutrition diva, Monica Reinagel. She's just back from the annual Food and Nutrition Conference in Boston. We'll talk about what some of the big new food trends are and lots more on politics coming up on the broadcast as well. On Thursday, we'll analyze the final presidential debate. And next Tuesday, Baltimore mayoral candidates Senator Catherine Pugh, Alan Walden, and Joshua Harris join me for a conversation about their ideas for the future of Charm City. If you're just joining us today, my guests are candidates for the Baltimore City Council running to represent the first district, which includes Harbor East, Little Italy, Greektown, and other southeast Baltimore neighborhoods. Republican Matt McDaniel and Democrat Zeke Cohen join me here in the studio, and we are happy to take your calls and comments. You can give us a call, 410-662-8780. You can send us an email, midday@wypr.org, or drop us a tweet at Midday Tom Hall. Guys, let's go to right to the phones. Dave is holding from Baltimore. Dave, welcome to Midday with Zeke Cohen and Matt McDaniel.
Tom, am I coming through?
You are indeed, sir.
And I think you're a poster boy for support for WYPR. Anyway, to Matt, your presidential candidate is tainting everything so horribly, and you're like a down ballot person. What's your opinion of him?
So, Matt McDaniel, this is obviously a question that every Republican candidate statewide is getting, the Trump effect.
You know, we will know what the Trump effect is on November 9th, but I have not endorsed Mr. Trump. I have not asked for his endorsement of my race, and I don't plan to tell people how they should be voting in November.
How are you going to vote in November?
We have a secret ballot. I might be one of those people who might still be undecided, so... Look, I get why people are – there are people in our district who remember manufacturing. There are people in our district who feel like they've been left out of politics. Those are people who remember Bethlehem Steel, remember Beretta, remember manufacturing jobs. And they hear Mr. Trump talk about that and are encouraged by it. There are also a lot of people who are downright offended by – not only the things he has said, but the things he allegedly has done. So I don't envy anyone their presidential choice, and I really wouldn't tell anyone to vote one way or another.
So what do we read then into that in terms of your capacity to lead and your instincts and your impulses as a leader, an elected official? I mean, if you're not going to take a stand on Trump-Clinton or Stein Johnson, can voters assume that you're going to duck some of the other tough calls as well?
I think having a dialogue and a discussion is better than telling people how a city councilman would vote on a national race. I've promised not to invade Baltimore County as part of my campaign. You know, that's the closest thing we'd come to foreign policy. But no, I don't think that that's an accurate comparison. Realistically, it will most likely not matter in the state of Maryland. But I also want to work with local issues, work with people across the aisle. And I honestly, whether it's Mayor Pugh, Mayor Dixon, Mayor Walden, Mayor Harris, whoever that person is, I want to be able to work with that person. You know, that's almost a more important endorsement. And I wish people would be asking me those kind of questions more. But yeah, I get it. It's the easy question to ask right now because that's what dominates the media, and I understand where people are coming from on that. So
let's take up a couple other issues, Zeke Cohen. The minimum wage, was sort of tabled for a while. It is going to come back up probably before the new class takes office. But your thoughts on a $15 minimum wage for the city of Baltimore?
Yeah, so I favor raising the minimum wage to $15, and let me explain why. When I was a teacher in West Baltimore, several of my students, their parents, not only worked, but worked multiple jobs at places like McDonald's and Walmart and Target and in hair salons. And they couldn't make it work living on $8.75 an hour. I believe in the richest country on earth that people who work full-time hours shouldn't live in poverty. And raising the minimum wage is important in that conversation. I also think that as taxpayers, we are subsidizing companies like Walmart and McDonald's, whose employees are often on food stamps. And it's a hidden cost, and people don't talk about it. But when you think about the amount of taxpayer revenue that goes into subsidizing these multi-billion dollar companies, I find that to be outrageous because they refuse to pay their employees a decent wage. Now, let me be clear also. I would favor exemptions for small businesses, and I think we should treat this with a scalpel. I think we should be very careful and be cognizant of our fragile economic infrastructure here in Baltimore. So I don't think it's across the board. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the problem, Tom, with the original legislation that Councilwoman Mary Pat Clark put out there was that there wasn't a discussion between some of the folks in labor and the businesses and the council people. It was just, you know,
But part of the discussion was the president of the city council and the mayor say, if we have this little island of $15 in the city of Baltimore, that business is going to go to Anne Arundel County, to Baltimore County, to Howard County. It's going to leave the city. They're not opposed in, you know, philosophically to a $15 minimum wage. They're opposed to it being only in place in Baltimore and not in the contiguous counties. Does it put Baltimore at a disadvantage in terms of business and attracting and keeping jobs?
Look, I would love to see a federal raise of the minimum wage. I'd love to see the state's going to go up to 10.10. I'd love to see the state move toward 15. And let's also be clear, we're talking about raising it in 2020 all the way up to 15. So it's not, you know, tomorrow that we're doing this. But I believe that this could actually be a boon for some of our small businesses, because we know that when people have more money in their pockets, they spend it locally. That poor folks, when they shop in local businesses. And I actually think this could be really good, but I think it should be done thoughtfully, and I think it should be a conversation. And I'm open to listening and hearing ideas on how we can improve the legislation and not just jumping in. But fundamentally, I do think we need to raise the wage, and working families should not be living in poverty.
Matt McDaniels, there's plenty of studies that will support one position or the other. Some that say it's a job killer, others say it's an economic booster. What do you think?
You know, I predictably might come down on the job killer side of things, but I want to put this in a little bit of a different perspective, as far as we like to say that it might help workers. But let's talk about what happens when you draw an arbitrary boundary between Baltimore City and Baltimore County with nearly a double minimum wage. Look, I majored in history and political science in college, and you have people who are might be working at Starbucks, might be working their first job, might be working during college, and they are over in Baltimore County. And they see that they can increase their wage by nearly double by driving a mile over into Baltimore City and potentially taking a job from a Baltimore City resident. I think that those sort of problems are inherent in making this arbitrary distinction. And more along the lines of talking about businesses, well, there are added costs to wages that aren't just, you know, being able to flip a switch. I mean, you have unemployment insurance, you have federal tax, you have the wage pressure of when you have a busboy making $15 an hour, the cook's going to want $23. And sometimes you have pass-through costs in terms of restaurants or other sort of employers who will either, you know, raise the cost of the service, or you have fixed cost industries where you businesses can't raise the cost.
Yeah, but forgive me for interrupting, but sure. Those are costs that are accrued by the business owners. What about the cost to the city at large, to the citizenry of people who can't afford to get by, who don't have enough money to pay the rent and put food on the table?
Look, I worked at McDonald's. I worked as a waiter. And it's not lost on me that we have significant economic concerns in the city. Raising the wage to $15 an hour doesn't treat the cause, it treats a symptom. And raising the wage to $15 doesn't give people job skills. It doesn't make them more marketable. It raises the cost of labor without raising the value of labor.
All right, we're going to move off of the minimum wage. There's so many topics we want to take up. We're going to go to the phones again. Jim from Harbor East is on the line. Welcome to Midday with Matt McDaniel and Zeke Cohen.
Yeah, good afternoon. I kind of wanted to bring it back to really First District issues with all the construction going on around here. To ask the builders to do more for the safety of the citizens when they're taking on these massive these big jobs and getting all these breaks for it. For example, this weekend, you know, it was all these tourists in town walking along Lancaster Street. At the corner of Lancaster and Central, it's a horribly marked intersection. There was a crane at the end of the street that got more protection than pedestrians. They had jersey barriers all around this crane, but the people are forced to walk out into the street with cars that totally disregard or don't see the really poorly marked stop signs. And that's just one example. I mean, they shut down sidewalks. They tell you to use the other sidewalk. You cross the street, and then there's another sign saying use the other sidewalk. So you have to cross the street again. Meantime, the streets aren't marked. And if they are, pedestrians blow right through, cars drive, blow right through them. And I've called the police. I've called 311. I asked for responses back for them. Never get any responses back. Can you, as a city council member, do any better with improving enforcement in this area?
All right. If you're elected, you're going to get calls like this all the time. Here's a guy living in Harbor East talking about issues, you know, that affect him very directly. How do you respond?
Believe it or not, I'm already getting these calls. Yeah, so we do have some challenges in our district with development. I actually think that seeing growth in Harbor East and around the waterfront is a good thing. But I recognize that it's created a whole host of challenges for citizens living there. And I would just say that I think where our city council has fallen asleep on the job is in not negotiating good deals with developers. And by that, I mean making sure that when we do projects like Harbor Point and Harbor East, that we are putting Baltimore City citizens to work on those jobs, that we are...
Where do you stand on Port Covington and the TIF?
So, complicated question, right? So I think that, again, the city council's job is to advocate first and foremost on behalf of the citizens, not for developers, unless those interests coincide, which in the case of Port Covington, to some degree, I think they do. I think the deal that we got was better than the original deal, but I still think the city could have done better. I think Port Covington and Under Armour is an incredibly important economic driver in our city, and so I'm happy to see the expansion. I want to see Under Armour destroy Nike and just take over the world. But in any of these deals where we are using public money to subsidize a project, I think we need to get really clear in our priorities about making sure Baltimore City citizens are going to work at a prevailing wage, that we're looking at affordable housing because we have a real lack of affordable housing in our city, and that to Jim's point about Harbor East, that we're being much more thoughtful in working with DOT and our city agencies about how people get around, because we need a city that has complete streets. We need a livable, walkable, bikeable city. A lot of the folks that I talk with, we think about how could this city become better for not just people that are doing business here, but the citizens living here. If we want to keep the people that are moving into these houses and condos in Harbor East, how can we create a city where people feel great living in Baltimore?
All right, Matt McDaniel, I've got an email here from David, who, and this is reflective of a bunch of tweets that we've gotten as well, and it concerns the fact that in the First District, you've got very affluent areas like Harbor East, Canton, Fells Point to a certain extent, and then you've got much less socioeconomically affluent areas. David writes, early on in the primaries, Mr. McDaniel suggested that we should build a virtual wall. He uses the phrase cops and cameras as entry and exit points to the nicer neighborhoods in the district. How can Mr. McDaniel suggest that his proposal isn't aggressively racist, and why should I, as a person of color, trust him?
Well, first and foremost, thank you for the email. Let's look at what does safety mean in our community. Safety means people being able to walk their dogs, people being able to park their car, unfortunately in our district, it's sometimes half a mile away from where you live, any time of day, and being able to walk home. It means being able to get up in the morning, go out to your car, and not have your windows broken and things taken. In my mind, there is, especially when we see our neighbors with cameras, who already have cameras, who are able to identify people who are committing crimes in our area. That's not, and it's actually a very unfortunate reality, that we have actually a very multicultural group of people who commit crimes in our district. So being able to identify criminals, being able to assist the police, being able to make sure the people who commit crimes in the district are caught and apprehended and punished, that's important. And, you know, to suggest that it's just
so right now, there's a series of private homeowners and business owners who have those cameras. But do you support a program in which there are cameras placed in certain entry points to some of the more affluent neighborhoods as a way of monitoring people that you may not want in the neighborhood? And how, through a camera, do you tell whether a person is somebody you want to have or not want to have in your neighborhood?
There should be no socioeconomic test for safety. So no, that's not about affluence versus non-affluence. It's about being the councilman for the first district and making sure the first district is safe. And as the emailer pointed out, it's we have affluent areas and we have less affluent areas. I think all of those people deserve to be safe.
Is it true that you advocate cameras and police stationed at the boundaries of parts of the first district to screen or keep people, to surveil people who may be coming into the district? Is that a good idea or a bad idea? And is it your idea?
Well, I think that that's a bit of a Orwellian take on it. I think that when we've listened to our police commanders who have said that people come into the district to commit crimes, even from West Baltimore and north of the city, and also from the county, from over the county side. Now, we are doing great work, especially with our new police commanders in the southeast, working with Baltimore County Police to start to apprehend people who are making that trek across the, across the city-county line. What we do need to have is the ability to identify individuals who come to our district in order to commit crimes. And if we're able to identify those folks and let them know that wherever they are, whether it's Canton, Fells Point, Grayson Park, wherever it is, and they're committing crimes in the district, that they will be caught.
Can you identify those people before crimes are committed? I mean, if someone's just walking into the district or riding a bike into the district, how do you know that that person is going to commit a crime?
I think the point isn't coming into the district. I think it's more identifying people once they've committed crimes. And this is No, absolutely. When someone has committed crimes, as we see online,
because people are saying that the impression that a lot of people have, I mean, if our tweets and emails are reflective, is that you're suggesting that there's somehow, you know, guards could be, you know, sentries could be posted at the borders of the first district.
As much as maybe folks are conflating build a wall with someone else in the political spectrum right now, but no. Realistically, as we've seen online and we've seen on our community Facebook pages, our community members have been able to take pictures of people taking packages, breaking windows. Those are the people who we need to identify.
All right, Zico, we've got to go to a break, but real quick, your take on public safety.
Let me just respond real quick. So, you know, Tom, we know the boundaries of these district lines are arbitrary. It doesn't matter whether you live in the 1st or 13th or 2nd district. Everyone deserves to come into our city, to be a part of our city, to spend time in the first district. We tried zero tolerance policing. It failed. It led to mass incarceration. And guess what? Folks get out of jail. They reoffend. We are trapped in this cycle. And the types of policing policies that Mr. McDaniel is suggesting are exactly what led us down this very dark path that we do not need to return to.
All right, we're going to take a little break. We'll have more on the future of the 1st District and the Baltimore City Council with Democratic candidate Zeke Cohen and Republican candidate Matt McDaniel. You can join the conversation by giving us a call at 410-662-8780. You can drop us a tweet at Midday Tom Hall or an email midday@wipr.org. Glad you're with us. Stick around.
This is your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall, joined in the studio by Matt McDaniel. He's a lawyer in private practice who is the Republican candidate for the 1st District seat on the Baltimore City Council. Zeke Cohen is an educator. He's a Democrat running for that same seat. You can join the conversation by giving us a call at 410-662-8780. You can drop us an email, midday@wipr.org, or tweet us at Midday Tom Hall. Got a bunch of emails and calls that we're going to try to get to. This is a question for Zeke Cohen from Joe, who says, what makes you more qualified than Matt McDaniel, who has legal experience and who has the experience representing small businesses in the area? And what are you doing to be prepared to legislate and to bring business to the 1st District and to Baltimore? That's an email from Joe.
Yeah, so thanks for the email, Joe. I've seen tremendous support from our small business community throughout my campaign. One of the things we heard as we were listening in our small businesses was that they really struggled, especially after last April with the unrest. And so instead of having a formal campaign office, we did pop-up offices where we would go into Daily Grind or High Grounds or Patango or any of the wonderful restaurants throughout the 1st District and launch our door knocking from those places. I just had a great dinner with some of the Latino business owners out in Highlandtown, Juan Nunez and Carlos, who owns Carlos and Charlie's. These are folks who are digging in, who are making it work, who are doing everything in their power and are really providing an economic backbone to our city, which has lost so much manufacturing. You know, I think about folks in Fells Point like Kelly and Claudia and Beth, who, again, businesses have taken a hit since last April, but are scrapping and are working hard.
Do you have specific ideas about businesses that should be in the 1st District that aren't, that you might be able to bring in?
Sure. So, again, we have a very robust small business community, and a lot of what I've been thinking about is how to support them. We also have, throughout our city, a lot of young people that would love a job opportunity but haven't been able to gain access. One of the things I want to try and push when I get in there is to strengthen the focus on youth employment. This is something I've worked a lot on as the director of The Intersection. But I would like to look at ways we could incentivize, maybe through a tax break, businesses, particularly small businesses, to hire young people. And not just as charity, but as a workforce investment strategy.
All right, let's move on. This is a question for Matt McDaniel from Greg in Butchers Hill. He writes, when Larry Hogan narrowly prevailed in the 1st District, there was a strong motivator. Voters believed that Governor Hogan would kill the Red Line transit project, which in fact he did. Without the threat, he puts in quotes, of convenient transit connecting Canton to West Baltimore, will there be as much incentive to vote Republican? Thanks for your email, Greg.
Well, look, I oppose.
You oppose the red line.
I oppose the red line. And look, it might have been a very good idea in 1998 and 99 when Governor Glendening, you know, decided to explore it. But it 15 years later, it didn't take into account the development that's gone into Southeast Baltimore and certainly the other issues that go along with a massive multi-billion dollar development project that would be over many, many years. On the issue of small business, because I think it actually segues pretty well, talking with Fells Point business owners who fought the highway, beat the highway, fought the red line, beat the red line. They don't feel like the city council and politics and business as usual is taking care of them. I mean, pushing a $15 minimum wage on those businesses would be a jobs killer. Focusing on the property taxes, the business tax. You have all of these disincentives to invest in Baltimore, especially for our small business community. These are the people, look, and
so what kind of incentives would you replace them with?
Lowering the actual taxes on the businesses. I mean, the personal property tax rate for businesses is about 5%. It's double anywhere else in the state of Maryland.
So are there particular programs that we could do without if we lose the revenue that would, if we have a loss of revenue that would result from a lower property tax?
Well, that goes to a much broader question of we need to grow population in order to raise the overall amount of money that's coming in. So you can't dump money right now into improving services without raising the tax base, without raising the population of the city. So we need to find a way to incentivize people to come to the city and then invest once that money is, once we have that revenue. Now, look, I want to propose revenue neutral tax cuts where we can actually be able to bring people into the city and as population grows, be able to cut taxes across the board. That is a proven way that, I mean, Boston's done it. D.C. has done it. It's ways that we can grow population. Boston grew at 6.5% in 4 years. It is a way that we can bring people to our city. And, I mean, going off of the small businesses, look at Boston. Look at the venture capital. Look at the health financing that goes into Boston. And yet we have Hopkins here. We have the University of Maryland medical system here. Which I think rivals anywhere in the world.
All right, I want to get to some more callers and some more questions. This is a question for both of you. We'll start with you, Zeke Cohen. This is from a paramedic named Sean, who writes, I'm curious about the candidate's position on the pending fire and police union's pension suit. Should the city honor their contract for a 20-year pension, or should fire and police officers work 25 years to earn the pensions that they were promised after 20 years? Zeke, what do you think?
Yeah. If you don't mind, let me just take the last question and then I'll talk about pensions. So I don't know how, as a city, we're going to continue to grow effectively unless we have reliable mass transit. You know, Matt mentioned Boston and New York. One thing they both have in common is an incredibly effective integrated transit system, which combines complete streets, buses, bike paths, and rail.
So how do we do that now, given the fact that the red line has been quashed? I mean, moving forward from this moment, what's the answer to improving mass transit?
So I actually think we need to continue to push for light rail. I am a believer that the program that the governor put out, the CityLink program, is inadequate. Basically, it rejiggers the bus routes. It moves them around. You know, and no disrespect to MTA, because I know they've done some studies, but the real problem here is that there is no true dedicated bus lanes. We don't have bus rapid transit. We don't have light rail. So a bus is stuck in the same traffic that everyone else is. And there's really no incentive for people to get on the bus that have a car. And as we see in Fells Point, folks are choked. We've got all these commuters coming from Baltimore County and Howard County, coming on 95, coming into the city to work in Harbor East. When Constellation Energy comes online in Harbor Point, it's going to get even worse. And so our streets up and down Fells Point become a nightmare.
Right. Okay. I do want to get to Sean's question about the pending fire and police union's pension suit. Where do you sit on that issue?
Yeah. So, I do think we need to honor our obligations as a city. During Mayor Rawlings-Blake, was there a need to reform pension and to renegotiate? Yes, I think there was. But I think for existing deals, I understand the frustration of our firefighters and our police officers because they are putting their lives at risk, and this city owes it to them to honor their pensions.
Matt McDaniel on the pensions.
Yeah, the city will most, not to comment on a pending lawsuit, but the city will most likely lose that lawsuit. It's the same general problem that Chris Christie had up in New Jersey. So that $30 million or more at this point set aside will be coming back. The city does need to honor its obligations. It made a commitment. It needs to honor it. I do think that reforms going forward, having talked with police officers and firefighters, they understand, especially the new guys coming on board, they understand that this system that might have worked 30 or 40 years ago is not going to be working going forward, but the commitments that the city has made, the city needs to honor them.
I want to go back to the phones, and the phone lines have lit up. I'm going to try to give priority to folks who are in the first district. Deborah, you're calling from Fells Point. Welcome to Midday with Matt McDaniel and Zeke Cohen.
Hello?
Hi, Deborah. You're on the air. What's your question?
Oh, I am. I was curious. I'd like to know what the council people think about some of the last-minute zoning amendments that Councilman Kraft has put in for the first district, one for the area that will deeply hurt the Port Authority by changing it to a mixed use, and then also about the taking the C1 and changing the floor ratio from 500 square feet to 300 square feet, again, you know, in March or so. So I guess my question is, are you comfortable with this? I just think we are moving a little bit too fast.
Deborah, thank you. Thank you for your call. This is often under the rubric of Transform Baltimore. Jim Kraft is the outgoing council member representing the first district. Matt McDaniel, your thoughts on Transform Baltimore.
Sure. This isn't against Jim or anyone in particular, but I don't like the idea or the implication of sweetheart deals for anyone. Especially when it comes to zoning, because that's an area where our council people have a tremendous amount of power, especially with Transform Baltimore. One of my biggest concerns, and I agree with Deborah that we need to take this slower. One of my biggest concerns about Transform Baltimore was the fact that a lot of people didn't even, or still might not even know that it's taking place. Certainly the impact on business, the impact on people who might start a business, the people who have bought a property and might want to invest in that property. It's the potential is there to lose, you know, hundreds, if not millions of dollars on your investment.
What can and what should the city government do to incentivize developers or assist developers? Is there any role for the government at the local level in terms of people willing to invest money in the city?
No, I think this actually goes to a question you had asked Zeke earlier, and I didn't get a chance to follow up on. Tax increment financing, or TIFs, and then payments in lieu of taxation have been used for several decades now in order to grow parts of the city. I don't think that they're necessarily appropriate in the first district, but in areas where you have the need for significant infrastructural growth, like in Port Covington, that's when a tax increment financing is appropriate. We've already gotten assurances from our legislative partners in Annapolis that that won't impact education funding, which was the big problem in Harbor East and those developments. But renegotiating, especially the education funding issue with property taxes, is critically important.
Mm-hmm. Since we're running out of time, sure. Zeke Cohen, going to have to give you the last word here. We have about 30 seconds. I mean, when the Port Covington TIF is over, that's been approved and signed. But just going forward, describe your philosophical approach to the city's involvement in helping development.
Sure. So,
just real quick. Sorry to.
No problem. Again, my job as city councilman is to be an advocate of the residents of the first district and of our city. I want to see development, I want to see growth, but I want to see it be transit-oriented, and I want to make sure that if we ever use TIF, pilot, any of these programs in the future, that we are putting Baltimore City people to work.
And we are going to call it a day there. Thank you both for coming in. Zeke Cohen, the director and co-founder of The Intersection, a nonprofit that works with students in the city. He's a Democrat running for the Baltimore City Council in the 1st District. Matt McDaniel is a lawyer in private practice who works on issues concerning small businesses. He's the Republican candidate for the 1st District seat on the Baltimore City Council. We've got links to more information on our website, wipr.org/midday. Today's the last day to register to vote in the November election. Online or by mail. Early voting begins on October 27th. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, another edition of Smart Nutrition with our nutrition diva, Monica Reinagel. And today, lunch for our guests has been provided by Joe Square. Joe Square serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. A reminder that you can hear Midday online anytime. Come to wipr.org/midday to catch our podcast or share a show that you think others might enjoy. Coming up next, stay tuned for Here and Now. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for spending part of your day with us here at Midday. Have a great day.